Hello, and welcome to The Musical Activist. I'm Sarah Nichols. I'm a pianist and composer, and I wanted to find out how, as a musician, I can respond to the headline that we've got 12 years to save the planet. On this journey, I'll be talking to experts and peers, climate scientists and other artists, and asking, what can I do and what can we all do? So, here goes. So today I'm really excited to be talking to Professor Richard Betts, MBE, who I know as the Head of Climate Impacts at the Met Office. But Richard, you're going to fill in some extra information about yourself.
Yes, I'm also a professor at the University of Exeter as well. So I work in both places, which is a great pleasure. Yeah.
Great. So thanks for talking to me today. We did meet the other day after my digital show in Reading. You were able to join us for the discussion, and that was really great to have your input there. So we'll get into that in a bit. But first, I wondered whether you could just briefly kind of introduce us to the area of climate science that you're working in and tell us a bit about the kind of work that you normally undertake.
So I do a lot of work on the future projections of climate change and the impacts of climate change. So trying to figure out what these future changes in climate will actually mean for people and the world in general and species and so on. One of the main areas I'm working on at the moment is I'm the technical lead on the UK's National Climate Change Risk Assessment, which is a huge undertaking trying to work out what climate change means for the UK, which is done under the Climate Change Act. So the UK's kind of ongoing, its own legal obligations to take action on climate change. So it's a quite monumental and extremely interesting piece of work to be involved in.
And when will that be sort of published? Or
so that scientific report from that will come out in the middle of 2021, hopefully. Obviously, a lot of work is a bit uncertain at the moment with the lockdown situation, and deadlines keep changing. But at the moment, it's scheduled for the middle of next year. And what will happen as a result of that is that the government, having looked at the science report, then has to write its own report to Parliament. Because every 5 years the government has to report to Parliament on what climate change risks and opportunities exist for the UK, and that will be done in January 2022, but it'll be based on our science report coming out next year.
Do you find that you experience any kind of tension between what you might perceive as the urgency of the situation and the slowness of this kind of work, of these massive reports that kind of take a year to create? You know, like, can you say anything about that?
It is an increasing issue. I mean, I've been working in climate science for 30 years now. So now the stuff we were sort of predicting 30 years ago, roughly speaking, is starting to happen or has already been happening for a while. So we're starting to see these things play out. So we're no longer in the situation of just saying this is what's going to happen if we don't take action. We're actually now saying, okay, stuff is happening. This is what's going to happen if we it's going to happen even worse or more severely if we don't act. But in the meantime, we're also advising on the stuff which is inevitable now that we have to adapt to in order to remain resilient.
What are the kind of key dangers that you foresee for the UK? What are the kind of obvious headline things that will impact us first, do you think?
The thing that's already an increasing risk is flooding, both coastal flooding and flooding from heavy rainfall. Coastal flooding unless you have better flood defences, it's inevitable you'll get more coastal flooding because the sea level is rising, and the sea level rise is an inevitable consequence of a warming world, as ice on land melts and puts more water into the oceans, and also the ocean waters warm and expand because seawater expands as it warms. So as the world continues to warm, we'll get more sea level rise. Sea level's already rising, which will increase the risk of coastal flooding unless we put in place improved sort of ways of managing flooding from the sea. River flooding and flooding from rainfall is harder to sort of pick out, you know, tease out the exact signal of climate change compared to what happens naturally, because we get heavy rain anyway and flooding happens anyway. So the thing is that happening more often, or is it more likely to happen? And in many cases it does seem to be becoming more likely. Again, the actual impact depends on what's in harm's way. Have you built on a floodplain? Have you got flood defences there alongside the river or whatever? So all that has to be taken into account. It's all incredibly complicated, but it's very simple to understand that a warmer world does mean higher, more intense rainfall, because the ground, when it's warmer, can drive more intense thunderstorms, for example, and a warmer atmosphere can hold more water. So when it rains, it's going to rain harder, and we're starting to see that emerge around the world already.
And do you think that we think in a sort of environmental way enough when we do think about adaptation? For example, I was reading recently about river flooding and like what a beaver colony might do, or indeed what increased forestation might do. And then you see kind of these projects where they want to spend £10 million building a concrete wall or something like that. Do you sort of think that we're, environmental enough in our thinking of mitigation and adaptation?
Well, this is where it's incredibly complicated, and this is where it's much better to not have the problem in the first place rather than having to deal with it now that it's here. But of course, it is here. We can avoid making it worse, but we've got to deal with what's already happening. So one example near me is the seawall at Dawlish. The railway line runs along right along the seafront above the beach, and it famously fell into the sea in a storm a few years ago. They're rebuilding it. The line is open already, but they're building a higher seawall, which is good for protecting the railway line, which is a very important route to the southwest, and for protecting the properties behind. The downside is it spoils the view, which may sound superficial, but I don't think it is, because people like to see the beach when they live there. That's one thing, and there's other more tangible things, like again, concrete sea defences can affect the local ecosystem. They might defend the land behind it, but the actual coastal ecosystem either gets squeezed out of existence or is just destroyed by building the wall. So it's always a judgment call as to what the correct thing to do is now. Yeah,
you've touched a little bit already on the fact that we're kind of already in the future that you saw 30 years ago and were warning about. Do you feel any hope that we can keep below 1.5 degrees? Do you feel any hope for this kind of thing that the IPCC warned about in 2018, which my piece was named after, this kind of 12-year alarm bell? How do you think our chances are looking?
Well, from a purely sort of physical science perspective, it's possible to stay below 1.5 degrees global warming. So we've not passed an actual sort of tipping point in the climate system that takes us past that. But what it comes down to is what happens in terms of human influence on the climate through emissions. And I think everyone would agree that it's enormously challenging to reduce emissions enough to stay within that target. When the IPCC published that report, it made it very clear that the changes that would be required are huge. So whether that is actually feasible within the next 10 years or so? I don't really know, but it's clearly an enormous, enormous challenge to do that.
So the Met Office obviously helps to inform government policy, but also you have recently been, you know, recognised for your communications to the public. So there's a kind of there's two ways that your messages can go, your science can inform. Do you think that the messages are getting through to the public enough, or what would you like to see more of in that regard in terms of how, as a nation, as a people, we become more informed about this?
I think most people are aware of climate change as a thing, as an issue. Whether they fully appreciate the full implications, I'm not sure, and also whether they can really sort of feel empowered to have any influence on it themselves as well, especially when you're, you know, just one person in your country, in one country in the world. So it's easy to think, well, I can't make much difference, really. So I think helping people understand more about the issue can help. Obviously, not everyone wants to know all the ins and outs of the science, but I think improved understanding can help. But also, better conversations amongst different people and figuring out how to move forward together is quite important, I think.
Mm. So, coming to the post-show discussion that you joined in on, so I had just there'd just been a performance of my 12 years recital story, which is the 1 hour 12 track piece, and we were talking about individual behavior change during the post-show discussion, and you came with a very nice point about language. I was talking about giving up things and you talked about seeing it as liberation. I was really interested recently, I just read a couple of sentences in a permaculture book, the Earth Care Manual by Patrick Whitefield, and he said, I feel it's important not to feel guilty about our lifestyles if we take the trouble to learn about the ecological impact of our daily lives. The process of lifestyle change happens naturally. It's not a self-imposed penance then, but a process of liberation. And you used the word liberation. So I'm just interested to ask you to speak for a few minutes about language and specifically sort of giving up or being liberated, and, you know, how you notice that different sorts of language has a different effect on people.
Yeah, well, I think it's really important how you view things like that. I mean, most people don't like being told what to do. Most people don't want to do stuff that they think is going to be bad for them personally. Everyone's like that. We're all human. I certainly am like that. But sometimes when a change is made, you find out that actually you liked it anyway, even if you were perhaps nervous about it or thought you didn't want to do it. A specific example for me is that I don't own a car. I live just outside Exeter. I can get around within Exeter and its local area easily by bike or walking. When I travel longer distances, I can go on the train. If I take a bike on the train, I can then complete my journey at the other end. Sometimes I do need my own vehicle. I'm part of a local car club, which is kind of a car sharing club, basically, which is one solution to that. Or I'd also get lifts off people who own cars as well. It sounds like a cop out, but it's kind of the same kind of thing. If you've got, you know, one car shared between many people, you don't all have to have your own individual one, you see. And I found this quite liberating, not relying on a car, because when I did used to drive a lot a while ago, when I lived in the southeast of England on the outskirts of London, I would drive every day as my morning commute from Kingston upon Thames to Bracknell, where the Met Office used to be. And it was so tedious in all the traffic on the M25 and the M3, and took ages and ages, and it was deeply unpleasant. And I think at the same time, another couple of things happened. There was a major oil spill off the coast of Pembrokeshire where I have a lot of fondness for that area, with family connections there. And I found it quite devastating that the oil had sort of ruined my favourite beaches. It has been cleaned up now, but for the time, the beaches were just covered in oil. It was terrible. And also, I have to admit, I was caught speeding as well, which was another thing. I just thought, all these things, why am I even doing this? So at that point, I switched from the car to the train, and I commuted by train. But now I live in Devon, and I live closer to work anyway. I actually commute by bike or on foot, and as I say, use the train to get around in other ways. Yeah.
It's very interesting. You said that when a change happens, people might discover they like it anyway. So this particular crisis that we're in right now, the COVID-19 crisis, the experience of lockdown will be wildly different for everyone. And some people will be having a much more intense and harrowing and really challenging time. And another swathe of people will be sort of trying to muddle through at home. And there's, for the people who are lucky enough not to be, you know, devastated by the disease itself or other, you know, experiences of trying to work through it, there is a kind of an opportunity at this exact moment of change having been thrust upon us. And, you know, people not having to commute to a meeting, not being allowed to commute. You know, I sort of wonder, do you dare to dream about this huge global sort of cataclysmic shift that's happened? Do you wonder how this can inform us? Do you create links in your mind, or do you shy away from it because it's sort of politically difficult? Or, you know, what's your feeling?
Well, I think in terms of what people do as individuals, which is only a small part of the whole thing, has to be said, but in terms of individual impacts, I do genuinely think that probably some people have discovered, like I did, that actually travel by means other than a private car can actually be really enjoyable, and you get to see more of the area around you, and so on. It's healthier as well. And I mean, everyone knows this, but often it's easy to sort of go along with your day-to-day routine and never actually kind of make the effort. But once you've had the stimulus to do something differently, you get into a new habit, which then you can continue. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot more people felt that kind of way. In terms of the bigger picture, I think if we are going to seriously reduce impacts on the climate and reduce emissions of greenhouse gases enough to really slow and ultimately stop global warming, it's got to have changes at the system level. Because one of the things that the individual change we've had in the lockdown has shown is that even though we've reduced emissions, CO2 is still building up in the atmosphere year on year. It's still higher this year than last year. So we need bigger changes, and that's not going to be a direct consequence of what's happened recently, because that's more been what individuals are doing. But I think it might kind of, people might be inspired to be more supportive of larger scale changes, and realize actually you can change things at a sort of societal level to some extent quite rapidly. We've changed our way of life, albeit temporarily, quite quickly. So this kind of thing can happen if there's a really good reason for it, as there was in this case. There was a good and urgent reason. So these things can happen if you have the will.
When you talk about systems change, what are the biggest things that you perceive really, really need to change if we want to maintain a livable world as we have it at the moment?
So the main thing is meeting our energy demands in a way that doesn't require burning fossil fuels. So coal and oil and natural gas, coal being the sort of the most intense in terms of its emissions. So I think it's just very clear that if we're going to slow the rise in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and actually stop it rising, we just can't keep burning fossil fuels. We have to stop at some point and start reining in soon. But that's a sort of that is a system level thing, replacing all your coal and oil fired and gas fired power stations with either renewable energy or nuclear power is a system level thing. It's nothing that one individual person can do. Even if you do put solar panels on your roof, the whole it requires everything to be done, and just solar power by itself isn't enough anyway.
So I sort of love to talk more about that, because I personally feel like as individuals we can flag the pathways to these things, you know, by, for example, choosing a green energy supplier. You know, that's a massive thing that we can all of us do. And then it's not just an individual change anymore. If the whole of society takes that responsibility, then suddenly you've got something really powerful. But because I've only got you for a couple more minutes, I'm going to have to jump onto another question, which is just something I really want to ask, which is, what do you think, how can the arts support you, you know, as the man writing the UK risk assessment for the climate? Mm. You know, what can we in the arts most usefully do? How do you see us helping?
I think the arts play an incredibly important role in people really kind of understanding within themselves what something really means. And I don't just mean sort of technical scientific understanding, but which obviously is important, but not everyone really wants all that. A lot of people do. A lot of people really enjoy hearing about and getting involved in the sort of the technicalities. Some people, you want to know what it means for you, and that's a very personal thing. And the arts can really help with that, with the kind of interpretation and kind of opening people's minds to an issue and allow them to make sense of it within themselves. So I think that's a crucial part of the conversation that we need to be having.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I mean, that's certainly where I hope to aim. I think it's that the possibility of raising questions, isn't it? Because I suppose in science, you're beholden to provide answers that you can stand by and prove with evidence. Whereas perhaps in the arts, we're freer to be able to sort of to leave question marks officially in the air as a provocation. There's all sorts of things I really would love to ask you, like, you know, if you had a 1 minute advert slot on primetime TV, what would you say to the nation about climate change? Can I ask you that? It's a pretty radical question.
Oh, right. Okay. That's quite a big one to be put on the spot with. 1 minute on what would you say to the world about climate change? I would say that it is real. And it is definitely our fault. We know this now. We have got to face up to the fact that some further climate change is inevitable and deal with that. But also, don't lose hope about avoiding the worst, because we still can avoid the most severe changes. But we now need to do things to both avoid the most severe changes and live with the changes that are already underway.
Great. Well, when I get that advert slot, I'll let you know. thank you so much for speaking to me today. And obviously, at some point, we're really hoping that we get to meet somehow, electronically or otherwise, sort of in, as it were, Exeter, so that you can be present for a post-show discussion with that audience. But until then, thank you so much for your time. And it's lovely to get to know you.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, thank you very much. Yeah, good to speak to you.